Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Tonight we are beginning a new series on the birth of Christ. In our first show, we're talking about specifically Paul's reference to the fullness of time when God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law so that we might become sons of God. I'm Kim Riddlebarger, and with us tonight, in a kind of an irregular sense, are our regular crew. Dr. Mike Horton is with us. Mike is a professor of apologetics at Westminster Theological Seminary in California, and also the Reverend Ken Jones. Ken is the pastor of the Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. Also with us is Dr. Rod Rosenblatt. Rod is professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine and is also a clergyman in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I'm Kim Riddlebarger. I am the pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Mike and Ken and Rod, as we talk about the birth of Christ and as we begin to think about the things that the Scriptures center on when we look at God taking on human flesh, do we sometimes get so caught up in the details of Christ's birth, things like when the wise men came and how many there were and so on, that we lose focus of the meaning of Christ's coming? Do we lose the meaning of the incarnation?
Well, it is interesting. In the medieval church, of course, there was a whole lot, so much surrounding Christmas that Christ got lost. And it's not that different today. In a lot of churches that I know you and I grew up in, Kim, the singing Christmas tree, you know, everybody was so busy with the singing Christmas tree and with all kinds of Christmassy stuff going on that we really didn't have a very clear view of what Christmas was all about. I'm not surprised when I see statistics showing that children growing up in even Christian churches can name the reindeer, but they can't name the disciples.
Yeah, somehow I guess we have gotten more into the pageantry and the gift-giving that we've even somehow reduced the fact of the incarnation to just giving. In other words, here's the greatest gift of all, and we forget that something else was taking place. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and in Him we saw the glory of God. But again, what we get are role models for proper gift-giving or the proper attitude in giving those gifts.
Yeah. So the sentimentalism of the season gets in the way for Christians of the true meaning of what Christmas is all about.
Yeah, many can remember a slogan like, keep Christ in Christmas, and that's a good thing. It's not to be criticized, but yes, the commercialism of the mall doesn't exactly exalt the incarnation.
So when we see Christmas celebrated in Christian churches as though we are coming to celebrate Jesus' birthday, have we missed the mark?
If that's all we're talking about. Because certainly in one sense we are talking about his birth, but if that's all you're talking about is a birthday for Jesus, then yeah, I definitely think that commercialism has won the day on that.
Don't you think this is the place too where we can bring up a topic we've brought up several times before, the two kingdoms and things heavenly and things earthly, and that we can say, for instance, that we'll have the gift giving, but we're not going to try to find some way to spiritualize that into, well, Jesus gave, God gave the best gift of all, because then that's just going to look like, as you say, Ken, God gave the really big thing above the Cadillac that Dad bought Mom.
God can give a bigger gift than I can give.
That's right. And instead, kind of separate them. In the Netherlands, for instance, that has been the practice where they have Sinterklaas Day, Santa Claus Day, a week before Christmas. And so there is a physical separation in time. That's when they give the gifts. That's when, you know, the Santa Claus lore and everything pops up. And then the shops really go non-Christmas, what we would call non-Christmas. They get rid of all the Santa Claus stuff and everything. And a week later, it is the feast of Christmas. It is a separate time where it's just given to, at least for Christians, if there's still Christians left in the Netherlands, who celebrate the Lord's birth.
Well, how then do we deal with the commercialization of Christmas, especially as Christians? Because Mike, you raise a really salient point that here, at least in the United States, the celebration of Christmas has become so Victorianized. Mm-hmm. In the latter part of the 19th century, you have, and not that I'm opposed to Christmas trees and that kind of stuff, but you had all kinds of traditions arise around the celebration of Christmas that became such a part of the family's participation in Christmas that what the church was doing and what the family was doing just kind of melded together. So now that you see churches doing the kinds of things that families did on Christmas.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was going to ask earlier, what are Christians to do as we find ourselves in contemporary America where Christmas is sort of forbidden? Ask any public school teacher.
Hmm.
What exactly,
mm-hmm.
what are we to do?
Now it's the winter solstice.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It's the winter solstice, or it's winter holiday.
And chestnuts roasting by an open fire, sleigh bells.
Holiday greetings.
Going neutral always means going pagan, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really
and
does.
And I don't think it's that clear. That's a tough one for me to answer.
Because I don't want the public school celebrating Christmas either.
Exactly. It's exactly that mess.
It's interesting when you think, too, that the Dutch Reformed contributed Santa Claus and the Lutherans contributed the Christmas tree.
Isn't that amazing?
So, you know, here we are criticizing the commercialization of... and yet, they weren't given as the be-all and end-all. They were seen really as things earthly. They were not treated as part of the worship.
Right.
Right. And now those things have become almost inseparable in many contexts in the American church.
But even if you look at the context of what we are celebrating, by it becoming so sentimental and nostalgic, and it's always warm feelings that are stirred during Christmas season, and certainly it should be a season of joy.
One more generation, it won't be.
Well, yeah, you might be right about that. But what we see in scriptures is prior to the advent, the coming of the Messiah, and the fullness of time. What was the fullness of time? And what scriptures describe is great darkness, utter darkness. In fact, in the messianic prophecies in Isaiah, in particular, chapter 9. It says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light on those living in the land of the shadow of death. A light has dawned. And of course, this paves the way for the coming of Christ. And so the celebration and the joy is that the darkness of sin has been overcome in the coming of Christ.
Right.
And that's what's missed. And so even the lights that we celebrate with really pale in comparison to the light of the gospel.
And that's the what's amazing about that is you can't help but think the prophets again and again and again are not only looking forward but looking back to creation.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
And here is the let there be light.
Yes. Yes.
The incarnation is God speaking into the darkness of the human rebellion.
Well, that's a great point, Mike. So if we can't do the sentimental Christmas is Jesus' birthday kind of thing, then what story are the prophets telling and what story must we tell as Christians as we think about the birth of Christ?
Well, again, I think that goes back to the darkness of that followed the fall and therefore the light of the gospel. Peter speaks of it the day spring from on high.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the language of scriptures. This is what the New Testament saints, as they reach back into the prophetic messages concerning the coming of Christ, this is the celebration of Anna, of Zacharias,
right.
Of all of those passages.
Right. And the whole theme we find in John's gospel between walking in light versus walking in darkness and so on, those are very prominent themes in the New Testament.
And the first two Sundays in Advent, the typical hymn you'll hear is "O come, O come, Emmanuel."
Yes, yes.
Right.
And every line of that
is
what a Jewish mother would have been thinking throughout the Old Testament. Where is this one who was promised to the first mother? That would crush the serpent's head. Every Jewish mother hoped that she would be the one to whom the angel Gabriel would appear, and who would have ever thought this? Jewish virgin out in the middle of nowhere gets appeared to. She has nothing to her credit except that she just happens to belong to this line.
Yep.
that goes back to King David.
And that's such a great story.
Mm. Yeah.
That it's a shame that that has been eclipsed and pushed aside by the sentimentalism of Victorian American culture, and then later, Rod, as you were getting, by the, just the crass consumerism of, yep, of the American economic machine that just revs up because your profit or loss statement is, you know, a make or break thing, yes, by virtue of how you do at Christmas.
Yes.
Isn't in that sentimentalization, isn't Christmas really ultimately Jesus as a type or an example of childhood in all of its innocence?
Right.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, we even sing No Crying He Makes, which is just a load of rubbish.
Oh, goodness.
What,
awful.
Jesus didn't cry? Yeah. How could his mother know to bear her breast to give him milk?
No, right, diapers he filled.
Right.
You know, it gets pretty earthy. Yeah. And that pushes us back to the main question here, and it's the question that I don't think people ask often enough, but you have to ask this. Why Christmas? Why this? Why didn't God think of some more obvious way? Why come in the form of a babe to fulfill this wonderful promise that the people would no longer walk in darkness? Why that?
Well, it's sort of typical of this God that it isn't in purple robes and in a palace. He's like that more than once.
But as David says in Psalms 51, I was conceived in sin and brought forth in iniquity. And so here we have this babe who has come to not only die for me, but to live for me. Mm-hmm. And all that God has required, he in his flesh, in his body, will accomplish that which I have failed to do. And so Simeon, at the end of his life, he sees the babe brought to the temple, this crying babe, by the way, and he sees in that babe his own salvation.
You ever wondered how faithful as he was, Anna and Simeon? That's fascinating.
It is. It's amazing. Yes.
How in the world? It's just another baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How in the world?
Well, and doesn't it too remind us that it's not like he had a choice. Either I'm going to come down in humiliation or I'm going to come down in glory. If he wanted to condemn the world, he would come down in glory.
Yes.
But he decided to come down in salvation. That couldn't have been in the form of glory because the minute he touched earth,
right,
we'd all be turned to cinder.
Yep.
Consumed.
Yep. We'd be consumed by his holiness,
yep,
and his wrath. We all think of Philippians 2, I think, at this time of the year. If you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be held on to tightly, selfishly, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Mm-hmm. Therefore God exalted him to the highest place, and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. This is the paradox, isn't it? That he rules by serving.
Yes.
And the temptation that Satan offers him is, hey, go around that whole serving thing and just become Lord. Just become the glorious king.
Bow the knee one time.
And then you got the purple robes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it isn't that. It's just the opposite. And that, I think, is what's so difficult about this. Now, as you guys discuss this, one of the things that just keeps bubbling up in the whole discussion, and I think it's something we ought to tackle, especially in this culture, which tends to see all religions as good or contributing something good to society, what do we do with the uniqueness of the claim that we're making? I mean, are we saying that by the appearance of God in time and in space in the person of Jesus Christ, are we making an exclusive claim here in terms of religious truth?
There's not a doubt about it. It's hard to find in churches today, but there's not one doubt about it. It could be, conceivably and logically, that all religions are wrong. What is not conceivable is that they're all right.
And this gets right to the heart of that question, that God.
It's un-American to not have everybody on equal footing.
Well, and as you say, there is this sense that people have in America that there is a universal religion and then particular expressions of it.
Yes.
And that's what we have to go up against. That is itself a religion. That is itself a religious perspective. And people are shoving that down the throats of people who actually do believe in concrete religions.
But isn't that exactly what the sentimentalizing and the commercialization of Christmas does? It just reinforces the fact that this is but one additional manifestation of the universal human religious nature.
Yeah, and maybe this is the place where the American and British Christian ministers, I suppose other countries too, but are called, especially in America, to confront. And it's not going to be popular.
Well, and this goes right back to, you know, people say, oh, this is so hard. This is such a difficult time. This is the first generation that .. Folks, the first century church, we're talking here about exactly what the first century church went through. The early Christians wouldn't have had any problems in the empire.
Yes.
For saying that Jesus Christ is probably even the highest, best expression of morality and goodness in the
right.
world and so forth. They could have gone on with their lives just fine. It's when they said, you have to go into your idol shed and clear it all out and place it on the bonfire and burn those idols because
yes.
every knee will bow in heaven and on earth to the name of Jesus Christ. He is the only way, the only truth, and the only life. That's what turned them into candles in Nero's garden.
Yes. Yeah, they weren't persecuted because they followed the example of Jesus. They were persecuted because they claimed that this Jesus whom you crucified was God, and he is the only means of salvation, the only means of reconciliation with God. And by saying Jesus is Lord, that made them vulnerable. But let's go back to something. When we talk about the incarnation, what are the unique aspects of Christ that are set forth here that cannot be made, the same claims could not be made for any other religious leader? Well, one is that this is actually God in the flesh.
God in human
yes.
flesh.
And secondly, that he has, when we talk about works, we are not justified by works. Well, no, we're not justified by our works. But Paul explicitly says in Galatians 4 that in the fullness of time, he was born of a woman and made subject to the law. So by his works, by his obedience to the law, we are justified.
Well, Mike, to follow up on your point, if this one being born is truly man and truly God, and if this is a... If this forces us as Christians to make a unique claim to possess religious truth in this person, how then do we go about communicating that, especially as Christmas is approaching, in such a way as to not offend people, not to needlessly push them away like we are some kind of militant fundamentalist sect that is, you know, running people off and using this as a way to beat people up? But how do we tell this story in a way in which we avoid the sentimentalism and the commercialism that bury the truth under the layers of junk, and yet at the same time keep that essential truth claim?
I think it's one of those that's the obvious that we overlook. It's just what you guys are doing. It's tell the story as the Bible tells it. Mm-hmm. If you're a pastor, tell the story of the incarnation and use the verses to tell it.
What do you think about voluntarily removing the nativity scene or a cross or any Christian symbol from public places where there is also a menorah, signs of other religions, anything that gives the impression that Christianity is one of these expressions of the universal religion of man?
I think it would be great for us to do, but in light of the state of affairs in this nation, what I think, especially this Christmas, we will see them join together like never before.
Yeah.
As a statement of solidarity because of what we are confronting.
And that's why it's so important that we be very, very clear about what we mean when we speak of God taking on human flesh and visiting us in the person of Christ.
It means he didn't visit Muhammad.
Exactly right. And this is a time, a year of yours when we must be very clear and especially clear about that particular point.
People need to hear what we're saying. We're not saying we need to take our toys and go home, and let's not share resources and wisdom where we can. In things earthly, we have plenty in common with Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and Jews. Our point is that the Christian claim that at a certain point in history, in the fullness of time, Jesus Christ was the fulfillment of all of God's plans for the world.
And no one else was.
And no one else can be.
Yes.
Is what it means to be a Christian.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.